Good afternoon, everyone. Everyone want to take their seats. The Justice Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Rosa, please call our roll.
Chair Brennan.
Here.
Vice Chair Smith.
Here.
Ranking Member Valdez.
Good afternoon, present.
Representatives Beltran.
Here.
Gracie Davis.
Here.
Campbell.
Here.
Duggan, excused. Fabricio.
Here.
Gottlieb, excused. Jacques.
Here.
Redondo.
Here.
Saroy.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Stark. Waldron.
Yeah, here.
Ex officio Gant.
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rosa. A quorum being present, I'd like to welcome everyone to the Justice Appropriations Subcommittee. As a reminder, please ensure that all cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or placed on silent mode. Also ask anyone wishing to speak before the subcommittee this afternoon to please fill out an appearance card and provide it to the staff. Good afternoon, members. Today's agenda consists of about 9 or 10 bills up for consideration, so without further delay, we will begin. The first bill up today is House Bill 1179, Litigation Financing by Representative Gregory, and show that bill temporarily postponed. Without objection, show that adopted. Next up is House Bill 1425. Do we have Representative Yarkovsky here? Juvenile Justice, welcome, sir. You're recognized to explain House Bill 1425.
Thank you, Chairman, Vice Chair Smith, and Ranking Member Valdez and committee. It's an honor today to be here to present this bill on behalf of the Department of Juvenile Justice. This is purely a good governance cleanup bill that aligns Chapter 985 with operational practices by updating and clarifying names and definitions, allows the department to educate the public and recruit and retain high quality and professional workforce, and amends educational statutes to conform to the creation of the Florida Scholars Academy, and that is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Yarkovsky. I see no amendments. Members, do we have any questions for the representative on HB 1425? Any questions? Representative Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Rep. Yarkovsky. Sorry I wasn't able to get connected with you beforehand. I just wanted to ask about the removal of the three community leaders on the board. Does that currently prohibit the board from moving forward with whatever business they need if they don't fulfill the three spots?
You're recognized, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the question. We were questioned about this on the last stop a little bit as well. The reason that we're doing this, taking it from five community members down to three and appointing the chief probation officer as the chair, is because we're having trouble in a lot of judicial districts in filling all those roles. So rather than mandate five, we're going to mandate three and hold the chief probation officer accountable to fill those, who is accountable to the department, the secretary of the department. Nothing would prevent or preclude the five from being on the board. If they are currently there, they will stay. This does not change anything in operations or anything to do with the product that the juveniles are receiving. This is just simply to make it more realistic so we can be in compliance with statute, because we're having a hard time doing so in a lot of districts.
Any other questions? Ranking Member Valdez, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Representative. Can you share how many districts this is a problem in?
Recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. I don't have the exact number, but I want to say it was upwards of half the districts. They were having trouble retaining and getting folks, community members, to be on those boards. So, again, like I said to Representative Gant, we're just making it more realistic and then holding it a chain of command accountable to filling those to someone who has to answer to the secretary.
Follow.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So if they don't, what happens then? If they don't fill those positions, what happens then?
Recognize.
Thank you for the question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It won't affect operations at all. They will just, you know, have to continue to hopefully go and find more organization leaders, community folks that would be interested in getting. But now someone will be accountable to doing that, and they're going to have to answer to the secretary as to why that's not filled. But it won't affect any operations if they're not filled. It's just, you know, candidly, less involvement from the community on that board. And of course, we want as much as we can. So.
Anyone else? Seeing none, we have no more questions. We have public testimony. I have first Quinn Diaz, Equality Florida.
Chair Brannon, Vice Chair Smith, Honorable Members of the Committee, my name is Quinn Diaz. I am the Public Policy Associate at Equality Florida. In its current form, Equality Florida opposes HB 1425. We respect the sponsor's desire to relieve contradictions in the state's juvenile justice system and improve long-term outcomes, and could support many of the measures included here. But as drafted, this bill could also result in inferior treatment for transgender youth in Florida's juvenile justice system. This is in direct contradiction with existing federal law, U.S. Supreme Court protections, U.S. Department of Justice guidance, and our own Juvenile Justice Department's internal best practices. As written, this bill would allow the Department of Juvenile Justice to deny access to programming, services, interventions, and facilities that affirm the gender identities of transgender youth. The sponsors have attempted to assure critics that these changes would not impede the DJJ's ability to meet federal PREA requirements, but just last week, extensive reporting found that Florida's adult systems are not fulfilling these obligations. If the purpose of this bill is to undo contradictions and improve outcomes for all, we must remove the changes from gender-specific to sex-specific in sections 8, 9, 13, and 19, which do exceed the scope of a simple conforming edit, so that there is no ambiguity about whether Florida can meet its federal requirements. Thank you.
Thank you. I next have an appearance record from Colin Brown. Colin Brown. Recognize.
Thank you. My name is Colin Brown. To echo everything that Quinn Diaz just said, this bill actively harms trans and intersex young people who are incarcerated by not providing gender-specific resources and only focusing on sex-specific resources. Young incarcerated people are already at risk. In 2022, a Florida-specific survey, 45% of LGBTQ plus young people said they had seriously considered suicide in the last year, including 54% who identified as trans or non-binary. These are statistics from the Trevor Project. In that same 2022 survey, 16% stated that they took action to end their life in the past year, including 20% who identified as trans or non-binary. I ask you to take into account the needs of already vulnerable transgender and non-binary incarcerated youth while considering this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We next have Chancellor Teal, Florida Department of Juvenile Justice, looks like waving in support. And I have the State Attorney, R.J. LaRizza, from the St. Augustine area. Proponent of the bill, you wish to speak?
Waving.
You're waving support. Thank you, sir. I see no more public testimony. Members, we are now in debate. Anyone in debate on House Bill 1425? Okay. Representative Yarkowski, you are recognized to close on House Bill 1425.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a couple of statements for the record. As it relates to the gender and sex issue, that bill was HB 1521 that this legislature passed last year, signed into law, statute 553.865. So we are not here to substantively discuss that. This was just conforming with the law that has already been passed. So I want to make that very clear. I also want to make it clear, and I've had extensive conversations with DJJ on this, under no circumstance will there be any change in current treatment services or practices that happen within the DJJ. You know, they're bound by a lot of restrictions placed upon them by PREA, and PREA requires a case-by-case analysis and placement as they're placing the juveniles, and their voice and their opinion matters. So I just want to reiterate, your vote on this bill will not change anything that is happening currently. This is just conforming in nature across the board. And with that, Mr. Chair, I close.
Representative Yarkowski having closed on the bill. Rosa, please call the roll.
Chair Brennan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Yes.
Ranking Member Valdez?
Yes.
Representatives Beltran?
Yes.
Gracie Davis?
Yes.
Campbell?
Yes.
Duggan? Fabricio?
Yes.
Gottlieb? Jacques?
Yes.
Redondo?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Stark?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Ex officio Gantt?
Yes.
13 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you, Rosa. By your vote, the bill is reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you, Madam, or thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll now move to CS for HB 1653, Duties and Prohibited Acts Associated with Death, by Representative Gia Lombardo. Welcome, sir. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, Ranking Member, and members. Currently in law, if you move a dead body, I'll give you an example, if somebody overdoses on fentanyl or any drugs and you decide to dump them in the river, moving that dead body is only a misdemeanor. This bill authorizes a person to report a death to either the district medical examiner or law enforcement agencies that has a jurisdiction over the location. It retains the existing first-degree misdemeanor offense for knowingly failed to report a death or refusing to provide medical or other information pertinent to the death investigation, creates a third-degree felony with the intent to conceal a death or alter evidence or circumstances surrounding a death. And that is the bill.
Thank you, sir, for that explanation. I see no amendments. Members, do we have any questions for the representative? Any questions? No questions. Public testimony? No public testimony. Members, we are now in debate. Anyone in debate? Sir, you are recognized to close on CS for HB 1653.
Close.
Wave close. Having closed on the bill, Rosa, please call our roll.
Chair Brennan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Yes.
Ranking Member Valdez?
Yes.
Representatives Beltran?
Yes.
Gracie Davis?
Yes.
Campbell?
Yes.
Duggan? Fabricio?
Yes.
Gottlieb? Jacques?
Yes.
Redondo?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Stark?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Gantt?
Yes.
14 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you, Rosa. Show the bill. It's reported favorably. Next up is House Bill 1393, Court Interpreter Services, by Representative Tuck. You are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, members. HB 1393 is legislation that repeals the indigency and cost recovery requirements for state-funded interpreter services to better align Florida law with DOJ guidance, and that is the bill.
Thank you for that explanation. I see no amendments here. Members, any questions? Representative Tuck on HB 1393. Seeing none, do we have any public testimony? I also show Sean Bernfin with the state court system waving in support. Anybody else? Okay. No other public testimony. We're now in debate. Members, we're now in debate. Anyone in debate? Okay. Representative Tuck, you're recognized to close on HB 1393.
Wave close, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Tuck, having closed on that bill, Rosa, please call the roll.
Chair Brennan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Yes.
Ranking Member Valdez?
Yes.
Representatives Beltran?
Yes.
Gracie Davis?
Yes.
Campbell?
Yes.
Duggan? Fabricio?
Yes.
Gottlieb? Jacques?
Yes.
Redondo?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Stark?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Gantt?
Yes.
14 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you, Rosa. Representative Tuck, congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Reported favorably. I'll now go to HB 1657, Criminal Offenses Against Law Enforcement Officers and Other Personnel, by Representative Baker. Representative Baker, you are welcome and recognized.
Thank you, Chair and members. This bill protects our law enforcement officers by updating and clarifying confusing language in our statute to reflect what the case law holds in situations of batteries on law enforcement officers. Case law is very clear. There is no right to commit a battery on a law enforcement officer who is engaged in the performance of his or her official duties when acting in the scope of their employment. Questions about stop or detention or arrest should be brought up in a courtroom and not with violence on the street. So this bill ensures appropriate punishment for those who kill law enforcement officers and will provide clarity to jurors who are engaged in one of the most important civic duties when deciding cases on batteries against law enforcement officers, and that is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Baker. I show no amendments. Members, we are in questions. Representative Baker on HB 1657. Representative Gantt, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Baker, my question is in regards to the language on line 27, namely the lawful or an unlawful. I know we discussed this before, but my issue is the usage of unlawful and how a layperson, a regular everyday person, would be able to reconcile if something unlawful is happening to them, that they wouldn't have the ability to defend themselves. So can you give me a rationale about this language being included in the bill?
You're recognized to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you so much for that question. What unlawful is referring to is what case law holds, which is you can't commit battery on a law enforcement officer, even if technically the arrest is illegal. So that's what unlawful is going towards. Even if there is no probable cause or reasonable suspicion, you need to bring up those issues in a courtroom, and then the case would get dismissed. You have to comply with law enforcement. So that's what we're talking about when we're describing unlawful arrests, not the behavior of the law enforcement officer.
Any other questions? Anyone else? Okay. Any public testimony? Any court? I have Jennifer Pritt from the Florida Police Chiefs Association waving in support. Jonathan Weber, SPLC Action Fund, waves in opposition. Matthew Forrest with the Florida Police Benevolent Association, waving in support. James Biardi, State Corrections PBA President, waving in support. R. Wayne Richter, Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, waving in opposition. A. Russell Smith, Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Well, he's got two marked here. He's got opponent in. Okay. I assume that's waving in opposition in the yellow. Is he here? Okay. Come forward. Welcome, Mr. Smith. You're right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, representative. I also want to address line 27, the language which would insert in the statute that it was not justified to resist unlawful behavior by a law enforcement officer. I think that despite the tragedy of Officer Raymer's death, the fact is that the case that arose from that was an aberration. It was a one single incident in a sea of cases where other results occurred. And so there's an old adage that bad cases make bad law. Usually applies to appellate opinions, but it can apply here as well. There is an erosion in our society of respect for lawful authority at all levels. Telling the citizens of the state of Florida that police can act unlawfully toward them, putting that language in a statute, approving the idea that the legislature has given its imprimatur to the idea that officers can act unlawfully, only raises the risk to lawful authority. I would ask you to consider what your constituents at home would think when they found out you supported a bill that in extreme circumstances would authorize a SWAT team or a team of federal officers or a joint task force to enter on their property without a warrant to do violence to their property and their persons while they could do nothing to oppose it. Is that what you want your constituents to think that you support? because there are political consequences to every bill. And that's one of the political consequences to this bill. I think there can be language that fixes this, that makes it clear that you can't use battery to resist even an unlawful arrest or an illegal arrest. But I think this type of blanket language makes a bigger problem than it solves. Thank you very much.
All right, next we'll have Jason. Let me mess the name up. Is it Cromie? Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers waves in opposition. Is it Antonio Wright, Orange County Sheriff's Office? Waves in support? Okay. Did I get the first name correct? Thank you. Aaron Waite, Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, wishes to appear. You're recognized. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair. Thank you, Chair, committee members, Brett Baker. My name is Aaron Waite. I'm the legislative chair for the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, representing over 1,300 criminal defense lawyers across the state of Florida. I appreciate Brett Baker talking with our organization on multiple times about this bill and hearing our concerns. Unfortunately, we cannot support the bill today in its current posture. As the bill says, the current law, and this is the part that's being deleted, a law enforcement officer is not justified in the use of force if the arrest or execution of a legal duty is unlawful and known by him or her to be unlawful. So essentially it's saying it's a current statute that an officer cannot use force if they know the arrest or action is unlawful. The bill deletes this language and should, again, the optics of that, isn't that problematic? It's certainly problematic for us. I would hope even the PBA in this room would believe it's problematic to say that an officer should not be using force if they know what they're doing is unlawful. That's a current subsection of the statute that we are deleting by passing this bill. Another concern we have is that the bill forbids citizens from using force when an officer is, quote, acting in the performance of their duties. And so, yes, there is the case law out there and a jury instruction that says the officer must be in a lawful performance of their duty. And we believe that's an important distinction, that in this bill, there is no word lawful. It just says in the course of their duties. We believe, as the representative mentioned, the case law is accurate, that if the officer is in the lawful performance of their duties, force cannot be used to contest an illegal arrest. So we believe our solution that we've had in talks is to add that lawful language in there and require the officer to be in the lawful performance of their duties. And we don't believe anyone in this room would object to that. So we appreciate you hearing our concerns, and we cannot support the bill today. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, sir. Next is Beatrice Lorente, Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, waves in opposition. Seeing no other public testimony, members, we are now in, one more?
I'm sorry,
State Attorney?
I may have put the wrong number, but I would like
yes, sir.
To
come forward.
Thank
welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank all of you for giving me this opportunity to address you today. My name is R.J. LaRizza. I'm the elected state attorney for the Seventh Circuit, and I was one of three prosecutors that handled the Otha Wallace case where Officer Jason Rayner, was shot and killed. First thing I'd like to say is there is a distinction between, there are different types of unlawful behavior. The type of unlawful behavior that we're talking about in this bill is like the difference between a speeding ticket, which is not a crime, and a reckless driving or a DUI, which is. There is civil unlawfulness and there is criminal unlawfulness. In this bill, what we are saying is that you cannot resist a law enforcement officer with the threat of force or the use of force while they are acting within the realm of their official duties. And it's situations where there might be a lack of probable cause alleged or a lack of reasonable suspicion. This is not an officer taking their baton and striking someone. This is not an officer who has some personal agenda and is pulling someone over for something that is not related to their official duties. That if an officer attacks an individual, that individual has a right under the state law and federal law to defend themselves. If an officer is committing a crime, that is not within the realm of their official duties. So while I respect my colleagues' concerns and their representations or perceptions about what this bill does, I can tell you that it does not allow, it does not prohibit individuals from claiming self-defense, and it does not prohibit individuals from the force of law when the officer is acting criminally while under the color of their authority as a law enforcement officer. And I'd just like to add, you know, I think all of us will agree that it can be a dangerous world out there. Every day when we wake up, we go to work, we don't know what might happen. And we could get attacked, we could be in a car accident. There are a lot of dangers out there. But imagine for a moment what law enforcement officers, each and every day when they put on their uniform, when they get in their car, they become a target. And like one of my colleagues said, there is a problem in our state, in our community, in our nation, involving law enforcement officers and the public. I have seen vehicles with bumper stickers that say resist. Law enforcement officers, in the Wallace case, Officer Rayner did not know Otha Wallace. He did not know that he was armed with a gun in his pocket. He did not know that Otha Wallace lived in that residence, in that apartment complex. He asked, "What's up? Do you live here?" And 28 seconds later, Officer Rayner was laying on the ground with a bullet in his head. What we're saying is to protect everyone, whether you like it or not, whether you agree with the law enforcement officer or not, if you make up your mind as an individual that you are not going to comply and you are going to resist with force, I think we would all agree nothing good can come from that. This doesn't just protect law enforcement officers, which it does. It protects folks, the general public as well. So while I urge you to consider that as you debate this bill, and thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, State Attorney LaRizza. We can't find that card. So, one of the sergeants, if you just fill us out another one, we'd appreciate it. Thank you, sir, just for our records. Appreciate your testimony. All right, members, I see no other public testimony. We are now in debate. Any members in debate? Representative Beltran, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you for the bill, Rep. Baker. Wasn't planning to debate this, but they TP'd Lit Finance, so got to debate something today. So, going to debate this one, but in all seriousness, there have been some issues that raised. I think the last statement that I completely understood and agreed with was, frankly, in the opening. So I want to be clear about what I think this bill is doing, what it's not doing, and frankly, how it's appropriate to redress any real or perceived improper conduct by law enforcement. And I'll start off by saying I don't think it's common. I've seen thousands of criminal cases, read about thousands of stops and seizures and searches and everything, probably about 1 in 1,000 times. You know, the police or the prosecutor probably gets it wrong. It's probably about 1 in 1,000 times, maybe 1 in 100 times. Seems to happen more frequently to my clients, but I guess that's a matter of perspective. But that happens. There are bad stops, there are bad arrests, bad searches. You know, if you look at thousands of cases, you see them. But in no way would I ever, in my wildest imagination, think that the proper way to redress that is by through some kind of violence. If the SWAT team ever comes through my door in the morning and, you know, they identify themselves as a SWAT team, and I hope they would, I would think it was right for me to reach for my Glock, and I'm going to barricade myself and fight them because I think I didn't do anything wrong, and I'm going to fight the police. I mean, that's stupid. I mean, I'm a good marksman. I think I'm a better litigator than I am marksman, but the proper place to redress that is, as Rhett Baker said, in the courtroom. I mean, think about that. You got a whole bunch of men. They got better guns than you. There's more guys who are going to come if you fight them. They got body armor. You probably don't have body armor. They get long guns. You probably got a handgun. And you're going to fight the police because you think that the warrant was bad, or there wasn't probable cause, or you didn't do anything wrong. I mean, that's just stupid. You're in a courtroom. You're going to get a lawyer, probably an appointed lawyer. You're going to have power of subpoena. You can get any witnesses you want. The cops can't shoot you in the courtroom. You're going to have a neutral arbiter decide on your Fourth Amendment challenge. You're much better off. Everyone in the United States is much better off in the courtroom than you are in the, doing a handgun fight or scuffling with the law enforcement out in the field. I mean, everyone should know that. If you've, some people are probably subject to those one in a thousand situations, and you know, that's frustrating, believe me, but you're much better off in the courtroom. Call a lawyer and redress that in the courtroom. You're gonna do great in the courtroom if the police, you're gonna get the exclusionary rule. Like, we have a very robust constitutional protection. I mean, you get evidence thrown out. I'm sure, Rhett Baker, you've had cases that you were not able to prosecute because the law enforcement didn't dot their I's and cross their T's. And it's not a perfect rule, by the way. It's not. They say the criminal goes free because the constable blunders. It's not a perfect rule, but that's the rule we've got under our constitutional system. So you're probably going to get off scot-free if the police did indeed mess up, and any competent PD, and most of them are competent, are going to raise that or retained counsel. The idea that you know, somebody's, and I appreciate, I've heard from practitioners in the audience that I respect, and so I appreciate the commentary, but the idea that it's good, the person who's going to be worst off, Suppose we didn't have this statute. Suppose we had a system that said, if you think the arrest is bad, you're allowed to fight the police, and you're not going to be liable for that. Suppose we created an immunity, which seems to be what the opposition to this bill is calling for. Suppose we said, well, you can be a one-man constitutional court out in the field, and you're going to decide if you think the police are doing the wrong thing, you can fight them. That's going to end, 9 times out of 10, that's going to end with the suspect being hurt. Not the police. I mean, the police are better trained, better armed. I think I'm repeating myself, so I'll kind of leave it there. Unfortunately, this is our system, and the rule is right, wrong, or indifferent. You go with the police, and you redress it in the court, and that's what I'm voting for, not to weaken our constitutional protections. I wouldn't do that, and I hope nobody thinks that we are doing that today.
I'll now go to Representative Redondo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Rev, for bringing this bill. I just wanted to echo a couple of the points. I think the state attorney made some excellent arguments. Beltran also did the same. I do want to address one other comment that was made about the erosion for effectively legitimate authority that we're seeing. I've actually heard from people I know that there is this sort of belief on the street that you can resist an officer if it's an unlawful arrest. And I think that's an incredibly dangerous thing to promulgate, because I'm an attorney, I'm a civil attorney, I don't practice criminal law. I certainly don't know enough about the criminal law to make that decision, particularly on the street when I'm being, whether it's lawfully or unlawfully arrested for whatever reason. Again, the proper mechanism to handle that, as has been said, is go hire a lawyer like me or any other one. We'll deal with that for you. And I think that, again, raising this prospect of individuals in the moment trying to decide, well, you know, is there probable cause here or not? I think this is unlawful. I think I'm entitled to resist. I mean, that leads to anarchy. It's a system that cannot work. And so, again, I think this really truly does create a system that protects not just the police, but also the individuals that the police are interacting with. And this makes it very clear. Police cannot go out there and arrest you because they don't like you. It has to be in the performance of their official duties. This is not going to create some free-for-all where cops can come and start doing whatever they want to you or anyone. And so for those reasons, I just want to clarify that, again, if you read the bill carefully, and I think if you understand the intent, as I know it is, this is designed to protect not just police, but members of the public that are interacting with the police, and to allow these sometimes complicated, sometimes not, questions to be decided in a court of law with attorneys and, you know, through the justice system. So thank you for bringing the bill. I'll be up on it.
Thank you. Representative Gant, You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am a criminal defense attorney. I started off as a public defender, and I still practice today. And I do read my bills pretty closely, and we had a conversation about that language and where I stood on that language. But I think it's, I think when we sit up here, we read the bills, we also have the benefit of the staff analysis that our constituents and everyday people don't have. So intent and what we mean doesn't necessarily mean it'll translate into real life application and even real life understanding, because when this, if this is signed into law, it's just going to be a statute. There are not going to be any, hey, refer to the committee discussion on the Florida Channel, or people aren't going to look at that. They're going to look at what it says here, and the language unlawful, with in tandem with the deletion of lines 34 through 37, does send a message to regular people who aren't sitting up here, who don't have law degrees. And we cannot sit here and ignore the reality that in certain communities, like my community, our interaction looks different day by day when we talk about our interaction with police. I have so many personal experiences, one being my mom going to Kmart when Kmart was open and being stopped in Hialeah, guns drawn in my mom's face because they said my brothers fit the description of a suspect of a bank robbery that's in the same exact complex of the Kmart. And it happened like 5 minutes ago. So, of course, if he just robbed a bank, he'll be with his mom walking into Kmart. Like, those type of experiences, having your mother call you hysterical and crying and barely being able to speak, you don't forget those, and you those are something that you just can't divorce from your experience when you go throughout life, or when you're sitting up here on a dais, and when you're looking at bills and how it will impact regular people when they look at it. And so I do have an issue with the word, the inclusion of the word unlawful, and then the deletion of the language in lines 34 through 37, because it does send a message, or at least it removes a bit of hope or goodwill to bond relationship between law enforcement and community. So I do understand other parts of the bill that we talked about with the clarification of the case law versus what's in the statute. So I do understand that part. But that language, I will be down today. I know you are still working the bill and working on the bill. So I hope that in consideration of the word unlawful, we can consider keeping the words in 34 through 37. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bracey Davis.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Rep, for reaching out to me on numerous occasions to talk through with this bill. I appreciate that. The notion that police can act unlawfully, I believe, is dangerous. That notion is dangerous. It's problematic. It also is concerning. I've said in this committee several times, I represent a majority-minority district for the reasons that Rep. Gant very eloquently lined out in terms of some communities and their relationships with the police. I think that notion that police can act unlawfully is dangerous. Also, something that was said several times today that really concerns me is the best place to litigate unlawful conduct is court. And while that may be true, it is not lost upon me that some people from some communities don't get their day in court. What if the person dies as a result of the police acting unlawfully? It's problematic for me. I too will be down on this bill because everybody doesn't get their day in court. Everybody doesn't have the opportunity to litigate unlawful conduct because there's this thing called death that could happen as a result of unlawful conduct. So I'm down on the bill.
Any other debate? That's it for me. Mr. State Attorney, In 1986 or 1987, I was a brand new deputy United States Marshal. And I remember being in the federal courthouse in Jacksonville in front of Judge John Moore. You remember Judge Moore? And my job that day, I went to Florida State Prison and picked an inmate up, and he was in a wheelchair. But he had resisted it was either a Jacksonville Beach or a Neptune Beach, Atlantic Beach police officer. And he had filed a federal civil rights, it was a civil trial, civil case, a federal civil rights case. And what struck me about that day, if anybody knew anything about Judge Moore, he was pretty no-nonsense. And the speed with which he threw that case out struck me as a young policeman that day. And he basically said, what we've heard is you do not have the right to resist an arrest. That resistance is what causes the escalation. So thank you, Representative Baker, for this good bill. And thank you for carrying out what a good federal judge threw out so quick your head would spin that day. That's what this is about. With that, you're recognized to close on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, members, for all of your comments today and all the conversations that I've had offline. I just want to thank everyone here in the audience for supporting the bill. This bill is very personal to me. I'm from the Seventh Circuit, where Officer Rayner was shot and killed. For whom this bill is named. I do want to point out a couple things based on debate. We're not giving law enforcement authority to have unlawful conduct. We're talking about a technically illegal arrest. If you read the language closely, I don't think it does that. Secondly, the lines 34 to 37, if the arrest or execution of a legal duty is unlawful and known by the police officer to be unlawful, they are acting outside the scope of their employment. That's what the criminal defense attorney will argue. So I look forward to more conversations. I look forward to hopefully persuading some of you of my interpretation of the bill. I ask for your favorable support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Having closed on the bill, Rosa, please call our roll.
Chair Brannon?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Yes.
Ranking Member Valdez?
No.
Representatives Beltran?
Yes.
Bracey Davis?
No.
Campbell?
Yes.
Duggan? Fabricio?
Yes.
Gottlieb? Jacques?
Yes.
Redondo?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Stark?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Gant?
No.
Eleven yeas, 3 nays.
Thank you, Rosa. By your vote, the bill is reported favorably. Representative Baker, you also have CS for HB 1545, child exploitation offenses, and you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. HB 1545 amends the offense severity ranking chart to increase offense levels for several crimes relating to possession, promotion, or production of child pornography. Florida is consistently lower in levels of scoring and punishment guidelines as it pertains to online child exploitation compared to other states and to the federal government. I believe there's room for some improvement in our statutes. So what this does is it proposes some increases in levels with these offenses. It'll help protect our children, act as a deterrence, and provide appropriate punishment in line with the severity of these crimes. And that is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Baker. I see no amendments. Members, do we have any questions on CS for HB 1545? Seeing none, do we have any public testimony, Rosa? I have Ryan Ellis wishes to appear. You're recognized, sir.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair, Vice Chair, and all members of the committee. First off, I want to thank you all for the opportunity to speak before you and for your time. I'm currently here on the behalf of the children of the great state of Florida, and I'm here on behalf of millions of child victims throughout the world. I'm a senior law enforcement investigator with 18 years of law enforcement experience, with almost that entire time working child exploitation, specifically child sexual abuse material and child sex trafficking. Florida, unfortunately, is a hotspot for crimes against children, and myself and my colleagues battle daily to protect Florida's most vulnerable and valuable, which are our children. After years of hearing from colleagues, victims, families about disparities in child sexual abuse material cases, we've all decided to do something about it, which is why we're here. Children deserve better, and it's just the right thing to do. As you all know, rules and criminal punishments are based around setting standards for acceptable and unacceptable behavior. Laws provide access to justice. Laws protect the most vulnerable in society. Laws encourage civil and political engagement, which we're doing here. Laws make human rights a reality. Laws are important for social progress. The primary purpose, as we all know, for sentencing, however, is to punish offenders and to deter others from committing such crimes and to deter repeat offenses. I won't bore you with some of the statistics here, but just to point out some of the things, in 2022, NCMEC alone, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, received 32 million cyber tips in regards to online child sexual exploitation. Unfortunately, that was a 35% increase from 2020, and those are just reported numbers. Those are not what is unreported. Unfortunately, that is up from just several years previous where it was only a million received. And unfortunately, here in the state of Florida, we're a hotbed and we received a vast majority of those tips. Child sexual sextortion is also on the rise, where unfortunately some of those children are even taking their own lives as a result of some of the online exploitation. So I hope you can all join me in protecting Florida's children better and reflecting the seriousness of such crimes by raising up those criminal penalties and guidelines. There were just several cases that I want to point out to you just so that there is no questions of why we're trying to do this. Is it the knowingly sale and transfer of prescription drugs to an unauthorized person, property stolen $20,000 or more but less than $100,000, all score higher than someone being in possession of a video depicting a small prepubescent infant being tortured and sexually assaulted. Now, while I'm not trying to take away from the seriousness of any of those crimes, I think we all know that there are different levels of wrong. So some of those offenses are even upwards of even second-degree felonies. If, for example, Medicare fraud, $10,000 or less, is even a level 7 offense, which is two levels higher than currently what we're at for some of the possession of child sexual abuse material. So I want to just thank you all for your time. If anyone ever has any questions for me, or even on the side, I'd be happy to clarify anything. There are many cases, even in North Florida, where I come from, that we see oftentimes offenders that are charged with the possession, the attempted production of child sexual abuse material, even in a local case, only scoring as little as 18 months. And we all know that even stealing a guitar and pawning it could oftentimes score higher. So I want to thank in closing for Representative Baker for all of her support. And I want to thank you all for helping to give the voice to the children in the pictures and some of those children who don't have a voice. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I don't have any more appearance cards, so members will now move into debate. Anyone in debate? Seeing none, Representative Baker, you're recognized to close. We'll see us for HB 1545.
Thank you. I'll waive close.
Having waived close on the bill, Rosa, please call the roll.
Chair Brennan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Yes.
Ranking Member Valdez?
Yes.
Representatives Beltran?
Yes.
Gracie Davis?
Yes.
Campbell?
Yes.
Duggan? Fabricio?
Yes.
Gottlieb? Jacques?
Yes.
Redondo?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Stark?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Gant?
Yes.
14 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you, Rhoda. Rosa, by your vote, the bill is reported favorably. Next up, we'll have a CS for HB 1255, Notaries Public, by Representative Porras. Welcome. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, Ranking Member. Members, this bill addresses crimes against one of the most vulnerable communities here in Florida, and that's our elderly community. Since 2019, in the 11th Judicial Circuit and Miami-Dade County, over three dozen cases have been filed with the elderly exploitation involving notary fraud and dereliction of duties. This bill specifically addresses these crimes and increases the penalties so that these notaries and these groups know that these crimes have severe consequences. And that is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative, for the explanation. I see no amendments. Members, do we have any questions for Representative Porras? Any questions? Seeing none, I'll move to public testimony. I have Jess McCarty representing Miami-Dade County, County Attorney, waves in support. Karen Murillo with A. AARP, also waiving in support. Members, we're now in debate. Anyone in debate on CS for HB 1255? Don't see any. Representative, you're recognized to close.
I'll waive close, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Having closed on that CS for HB 1255, Rosa, please call our roll.
Chair Brannon?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Yes.
Ranking Member Valdez?
Yes.
Representative Beltran?
Yes.
Gracie Davis?
Yes.
Campbell?
Yes.
Duggan? Fabricio?
Yes.
Gottlieb? Jacques?
Yes.
Redondo?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Stark?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Gant?
Yes.
14 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you. Show the bill reported favorably. Next up is CS for HB 1171, Communications Fraud by Representative Steele. Welcome, sir. You are recognized.
Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, Ranking Member, and Committee. I'm here to talk to you about HB 1171, or CS for HB 71. It's a new, basically changing the definition of a scheme to defraud. It's protecting senior citizens, age 65 and older, children under the age of 18, and then anybody that's disabled or mentally disabled from being defrauded by using their image and likeness in endorsements. So that is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. I see no amendments. Members, do we have any questions? Any questions? Representative Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Rep. Steele, can you, maybe I'm confused in my reading of the bill.
Okay.
Lines 66 to 67, so subsection C in its totality, it is increasing misdemeanor to first degree, so on and so forth. So we are saying that a felony in the first degree is now reclassified to a life felony in this bill?
Recognize.
Yes, if it's fits the criteria for the individuals, it increases the crime when it's done against an individual 65 or older, a child, or a mental or physically disabled person.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what in this bill would qualify under subsection C4 for a person to spend the rest of their life in prison?
Recognize.
Can you restate the question?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what would qualify for subsection C4 as the threshold? What's the threshold for a person to be sentenced to life?
Recognize.
I don't have that answer. I can talk to you offline about that.
Anybody else? Any other questions? Okay. Now, in public testimony, I have Karen Murillo with AARP waving in support. Members, we're now in debate. Anyone in debate? Rep. Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Steele, I 100% understand the need to protect the population that's included in this bill. I would like to further understand what would qualify a person spending the rest of their life in prison under this bill. I think that is a lot, and that's the least of how I can describe it. So I guess we will talk offline about subsection C4, and it just, I understand the intent, but a person's natural life in prison, I have to really understand what that looks like, what the state attorney would be looking at to find the level of egregiousness in a crime that would say if a person isn't physically hurt or dead, that now you're going to prison for the rest of your life. And I didn't get that information reading the bill, but I would love to talk about that today. I will be down on the bill, but I would love to talk about that.
Anyone else in debate? All right, Representative Steele, you're now recognized to close on CS for HB 1171.
Listen, I thank you for your comments, and thank you, Chair, for hearing my bill. Absolutely open. My door's open. Anytime you want to come over and we can discuss this, if we need to make changes, obviously I'm open to it. So thank you, guys.
Representative Steele, having closed on his bill, Rosa, please call the roll.
Chair Brannon?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Yes.
Ranking Member Valdez?
No.
Representatives Beltran?
Yes.
Bracy Davis?
No.
Campbell?
No.
Duggan? Fabricio?
Yes.
Gottlieb? Jacques?
Yes.
Redondo?
Yes.
Saroy? Snyder?
Yes.
Stark?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Gant?
No.
Nine yeas, four nays.
Thank you, Rosa. By your vote, the bill is reported favorably.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. We'll now have CS for HB 449, Motor Vehicle Racing Penalties, by Representative Michael. Welcome, and you are recognized.
Good afternoon, Chair, Ranking Member, members of the committee. PCS for HB 449 addresses the increasing and dangerous issues related to street racing, drag racing, stunt driving, and street takeovers. This bill is needed because we have a public safety issue anywhere from Jacksonville to Orlando to Tampa to Miami. The current penalties for racing and stunt driving does not provide a deterrent for many individuals. The bill removes or applies uniform penalties instead of applying separate penalties for specified violations. It keeps standard violations as a first-degree misdemeanor, but it increases the fine. It increases the fine for a third or a subsequent violation within 5 years. It increases the spectator fine. It adds a third-degree felony for any person who knowingly impedes, obstructs, interferes with an authorized emergency vehicle that is on call or responding to an emergency, and creates a second-degree felony for a second or a suspensory offense. Members, that is the bill.
Thank you, Representative Michael. I see no amendments. Members, do we have any questions? We'll see us for HB 449. Any questions? Right, no questions. Public testimony, I have... Captain Antonio Wright with the Orange County Sheriff's Office waving in support. And Jess McCarty, Miami-Dade County Executive Assistant County Attorney, waving in support. No other public testimony. Members, we're now in debate on Representative Michael's bill. Anybody in debate? Okay. Representative Michael, you're recognized to close on CS for HB 449.
Thank you, Chair. This is a great bill, and hopefully it will help deter both the participation in as well as being a spectator of street racing, drag racing, stunt racing, and street takeovers, which endangers everyone and it blocks public safety vehicles during emergencies. I ask for your favorable support.
Thank you, Representative Michael. Having closed on the bill, Rosa, please call the roll.
Chair Brannon?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith? Ranking Member Valdez?
Yes.
Representatives Beltran?
Yes.
Bracy Davis?
Yes.
Campbell?
Yes.
Fabricio?
Yes.
Duggan? Gottlieb? Jacques?
Yes.
Redondo?
Yes.
Saroy? Snyder?
Yes.
Stark?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Gant?
Yes.
13 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you, Rosa. By your vote, members, the bill is reported favorably. Now move to CS for HB 453, Forensic Genetic Genealogy Grants, by Representative Anderson, and I think Representative Jocks is going to be filling in for him, and you are recognized, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 453 establishes a grant program to be administered by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement that will provide additional resources to law enforcement to help them solve unsolved cases, as well as future cases, using forensic genetic genealogy technology, also known as FGG for short. FGG for short. FGG technology uses DNA markers and genealogy to solve crimes in three key areas. These three areas are cold cases, unidentified human remains, as well as sexual assaults. That is the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Jocks. I see no amendments. Members, do we have any questions? You're recognized, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that this is Representative Anderson's bill, and my questions are referred to FDLE. So I wanted to ask you, Mr. Chair, if I can refer my questions to FDLE when they speak up for testimony. I only got two.
Are they going to speak up? I don't know. So I don't even know. I see their legislative person coming up, Bobby Smith. But let's just have a seat right there. Let's hang on. We'll see. Anybody else? Any other members with any questions? Representative Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I understand that the markers are at 100,000. What is the rationale for requiring DNA technology that uses 100,000 markers in order to be eligible for the grant?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At 100,000, it would be able to capture more potential leads. Currently, the FBI standard is 500,000, whereas based on FDLE's standards, they think they can get more crime solved if we do have the 100,000 genetic markers. And so it's a way to capture more. And there's already 4 to 5 labs that already have contracts with FDLE that tests at the 100,000 marker standard.
Follow up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So my understanding that this is to capture or to help solve more cold cases. So what happens in the instance where it is a cold case and there has been some denigration or deterioration, I don't know the correct terminology in this DNA setting, but a breakdown of the markers and it's not quite 100,000, would they be precluded from applying for the grant, or is there any mechanism where they could qualify?
Recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, they wouldn't be precluded from that. So the 100,000 mark is just a standard, but it doesn't mean any other markers, even lower or higher, would be precluded. But this sets up the standard and the framework for this program.
One more. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding the technology that the labs use, is it the same technology that the FBI uses, or is it a common technology that's used across different states? What does that technology look like in comparison to what's being used nationally?
Recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, this is recognized technology that is being used nationally in other states as well. As I mentioned earlier, the FBI uses a 500,000 marker for their testing. And so 100K would be able to capture quite a bit. So a way to describe it is you could be able to get 5 to 6 cousins, you know, based on this level of marker, whereas, say, a 10,000 marker, you might get to second cousins, you know, as far as the parameters and the folks that could be reached as far as DNA potential links.
Mr. Chair, I know I said that.
You can have another. Okay, you're right. You're right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I know that the goal is to solve the cold cases. Do we know how many, and you may not know the answer to this, but what potentially would the impact be on how many cold cases could be addressed at this marker? And conversely, how many would not qualify? And you may not know that, so just wondering.
You're recognized, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So currently in Florida, we have 19,000 cold cases. And now, while not every case would be suitable for FGG technology, 75% of these unsolved homicide cases do have DNA evidence that would make them eligible. So we're looking at 75% of 19,000. cold cases.
You good? Okay. Anyone else? Let's see. We've got, yep, here we got Natalie Kudo or Cato. No one else in questions? Okay, we got one appearance card here with Natalie, DNA Labs. Waving opposition. Is she here? Okay, she's waving in opposition, it looks like. All right, I do not have a card for, so she's not scheduled to speak, so I think it would be out of order if you probably asked her some questions because she's not on the list to speak, Representative Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then can I pose my questions to the substitute bill sponsor?
You can. Well, thank we're you. Past that. No, you can't. I'm sorry. No, did we?
Mr. Chair?
Well, she had, and then I don't think it's fair to put her on the spot right here at the last minute and have her sign a form. She's maybe not prepared, so I'm not gonna allow that. Hmm. All right. We are now in debate. Anybody in debate? Rep. Campbell's in debate. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, since I can't ask my question during question period, I'll just go ahead and pose a question. Hopefully the chair can answer. The two questions that I had regarding the bill is just how many DNA markers typically does
hey,
that...
We're in debate.
This is part of my debate. Part of my debate. It's part of my debate.
Well, he said he wanted the chair to answer it, but so is it a question or debate?
I'm sorry, the bill sponsor, I'm sorry. Okay. I missed my words. The bill sponsor in his closing. But just my curiosity rises is just how much markers does FDL typically require in these types of forensic genetic genealogy tests? And then also, how many have they been able to secure at the number that they typically are at from more than one vendor? And so hopefully I can get that answered. But if not, I would love to kind of talk offline a little bit more about the process and just learning about this bill.
You are certainly welcome to do that, and I'm sure she'll be glad to discuss it with you after the meeting. Members, any more debate? Okay. Representative Michael, Representative Jocks, you don't look like her. Representative Jocks, you are recognized to close on Representative Anderson's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I mentioned, this bill sets up this grant program to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement that would establish forensic genetic genealogy technology in three key areas that will solve a lot of unsolved cases and future cases. So in cold cases, as I mentioned, we're talking about 19,000 cold cases in Florida that could be eligible for this type of grant funding, 75% of them, and we can know what occurred in these cases and bring individuals to justice. This can also be used in unidentified human remains. According to the Federal Unidentified Persons Database, AKA NAMIS, there are currently 904 unidentified human remains cases in Florida. 99% of these cases would be suitable for FGG testing. And then when it comes to sexual assaults, Mr. Chairman, there is currently no official federal database, but the number of unsolved cases is estimated to be over 1,000 statewide. This type of technology will go towards solving these cases. And with that, I ask for your favorable support.
Thank you, sir. Representative Jock, having closed on the bill, Rosa, call the roll for us.
Chair Brennan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Yes.
Ranking Member Valdez?
Yes.
Representatives Beltran?
Yes.
Gracie Davis?
Yes.
Campbell?
Yes.
Duggan? Fabricio?
Yes.
Gottlieb? Jacques?
Yes.
Redondo?
Yes.
Saroy? Snyder?
Yes.
Stark?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Gant?
Yes.
13 yeas, 0 nays.
Okay, by your vote, the bill is reported favorably. This will conclude today's agenda without any other business which may properly be presented. Representative Snyder moves, we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.